From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, a big week of news, including congressional testimony from the president's former lawyer.
Mr. Trump directed me to use my own personal funds from a home equity line of credit to avoid any money being traced back to him.
We'll break it down in our week in review. Also today, can the Celtics end their losing streak?
We're desperate for a win and to feel good about ourselves. That time will come when that time comes, and wherever we are, we'll play.
And we travel down the yellow brick road, remembering Dorchester's Ray Bolger. He played the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz.
It was a very simple philosophy that everybody had a heart, that everybody had a brain, that everybody had courage.
There's no place like Radio Boston. 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 Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and it's another explosive week in Washington as Congress puts the spotlight on President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. He spent 3 days testifying on Capitol Hill, including an open session on Wednesday. He didn't hold back.
I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
But the fireworks didn't stop there.
Did the president know what was happening?
Oh, yes.
And how did you know he knew what was happening?
Because he tasked me to find the straw bidder.
I want everyone in this room to think about this. The first announced witness for the 116th Congress is a guy who is going to prison in 2 months for lying to Congress.
Mr. Trump directed me to use my own personal funds from a home equity line of credit to avoid any money being traced back to him.
Your star witness here broke the law with regards to the IRS at least 5 times.
Your side ran away from the truth, and we're trying to bring it to the American people.
Liar, liar, pants on fire.
So where does all of this leave us? And there's a lot to unpack here, so let's get right to it with our Week in Review panelists. Joining me here in studio is Jennifer Nasur. She's former chair of the Massachusetts GOP and CEO of Reflect Us. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, good to have you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So that Wednesday testimony, kind of exhausting. Cohen made a lot of serious claims against his former boss, but I'll note that he didn't make the biggest one of all, and that's collusion with Russia. So, Jennifer, I'll start with you. What stood out to you from this marathon session on Wednesday?
So I think that Michael Cohen probably watched too many Godfather movies and The Goodfellas too many times because, I mean, he just nailed some characters out of those movies.
I kept expecting some brother from Sicily to show up and sit in the background there and just stare at him.
I mean, New York at its very best. And I am originally from New York. And, you know, I think that that was the biggest takeaway. In all seriousness, though, I think that there are some very interesting distinctions between what's morally reprehensible and what is criminal conduct. So that's number one. Number two, you know, Cohen is a liar, and so now he's going to jail. I really forget about any of your views on the president.
Mm-hmm.
This is about Michael Cohen and Michael Cohen's week. He is now able to start writing his book during his 3 years in jail. And this was a perfect opportunity for him to start his little PR tour before he gets sent away. And then he can start writing his book. So when he comes out, he actually has some salary because he was just disbarred this week as well.
So you bring up an interesting point. He's looking out for his own skin here. Michael, what did you see in this testimony this week?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I kept thinking of the proverb and a little spin on the proverb. Hear no truth, see no truth, speak no truth. And the three monkeys, as they say that. And the reason I say that is I think one is I don't think anyone does not believe that our president is a crook. And as was pointed out in his testimony, Cohen's testimony, he said bank fraud, tax fraud and campaign finance violations. If you're denying that at this point, then you're just an idiot. Like you just don't want to defend him by any means necessary. So I think that was interesting to me that we're now starting to see from and though Cohen has credibility issues, the way our system works is that people come before you, they're imperfect. They're liars, they're cheats, they're co-conspirators. But
Michael,
still
I should note the president hasn't been brought up on any of those charges.
Not at all. Not at all. But I think it's headed that way. I think ultimately the castle's crumbling and you're having more and more people, though they're not they're shady characters, who are now starting to turn on our president and reveal the president that we all knew him to be.
Can we really believe anything from someone who's facing all this prison time and who's personally motivated to save his own skin in this book deal, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's a, you know, did anyone think that the president wasn't a racist before he was elected to office? The answer is no. Did anyone think he wasn't a sexist before he was elected to office? The answer is no. We knew this information. The man was still elected to office. So at this point, right, I think that Trump is enough of a businessman to know where he can push the limits. And so whether anything that he has done rises to the level of criminal conduct is more of the question. So things that Cohen was saying, it's stuff that we already, kind like Michael said, it's nothing new. It was no new information. Nothing was shocking, I think, to either side. It was an amazing attempt for Congress to do a little grandstanding for the Republicans to go out and try to protect the president, which is amazing, and for the Democrats to go out and do what they've been waiting to do, which is slam him publicly.
But I think from the standpoint of giving us a fuller picture of who 45 is, that's what it mattered. That's what it mattered to many of us, right? So just on the issue of race and his comments about folks in Chicago and his sort of racist comment that he made to Cohen and probably many others, it's just a validation. I think more of that builds up. And hopefully we turn the country to a place we realize that this president is a racist. And I know we're always cautious about using that word. I'm not, because I know what it means. Most of these folks who talk about it have no idea even what a racist is by definition. So I think that his testimony was critical. It provides the picture of the president that we all know him to be. And then eventually we have to act on it.
So, you know, President Trump says he's a nationalist, not a racist. And we do have some clips here from that testimony on Wednesday, where you know, this little bit of an exchange between Michael Cohen and North Carolina Representative Republican Mark Meadows, because that charge of racism didn't sit well with Meadows. And so he invited Lynn Patton, she's an African-American Trump administration official, to stand behind him during his line of questioning.
You made some very demeaning comments about the president that Ms. Patton doesn't agree with. In fact, it has to do with your claim of racism. She says that as a daughter of a man born in Birmingham, Alabama, that there is no way that she would work for an individual who was racist. How do you reconcile the two of those, Mr.
As neither should I, as the son of a Holocaust survivor.
And then that exchange sparked an extended argument between Congressman Meadows and Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib.
The fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman, in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself. Donald Trump is setting
Mr.
the president.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that her words
Donald
be
Trump
taken
is setting
down.
A president. I reclaim my time.
Mr.
Donald
Chairman,
Trump is setting a president.
Mr. Chairman,
the highest office can be
Mr. Chairman, the rules are clear.
Activity.
What are you hearing that, Michael?
It's so disturbing. So I think I think he needs an education on what racism is and its basic components to that is prejudice plus power and privilege. And we need to have a fuller conversation about that because I tell people all the time, I'm sexist. I grew up in a sexist society. It's not like I woke up one day and eliminated all the indoctrination that I've gotten through a course of a lifetime about women. So I'm working constantly to address that. In his case, I think what's interesting is you can go back to slavery and five Africans who were in favor of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. You can go to Bull Connor and Governor Wallace and find black folks who thought they were great people and they weren't racist. That's not the point. Your policies are racist. Your behavior is racist. And in his case, he was a birther. You can't get more racist than that. He basically
talking about Meadows.
Right.
He said in 2012, you know, wants to send President Obama back home to
back
Kenya
to Africa
or wherever it is. Yeah. Jennifer.
OK, number one, I just want to say, Michael, I at right now have, and I've always had a ton of respect for you, I have even more respect for you because it takes a real strong person to admit that they are working on something that they were born into a culture of. And so I endorse you for anything that you ever want to do because, God, we need more people like that. You know, it is a very big problem. And I think that one of the biggest problems that the Republican Party is suffering with right now is the tone deafness, right? And it's one thing, like Michael said, having something and knowing that because of the time you were born, because of your family, because of whatever, that this is in your head. Mm-hmm. But there's an opportunity right now for everyone to start opening up their minds and understanding that we can all learn from each other, and every day is going to be learning, and every day is going to be an opportunity to grow. And I think what Congressman Meadows was exhibiting was in his own head, he thought this is gigantic growth on his part. But there is a level of tone deafness. And I think that all of our elected officials need to take a deep breath and know that everything that they say has consequences, and it has far-reaching consequences.
Well, and sort of to that point, Ayanna Pressley, Congresswoman from Massachusetts, kind of made a point along those lines. Let's listen to what she said.
Would you agree that someone could deny rental units to African Americans, lead the birther movement, refer to the diaspora as countries, and refer to white supremacists as fine people, have a black friend, and still be racist?
Yes.
I agree.
I'm assuming you agree with that, Michael.
I would agree. She put him to the test, because that's exactly what it is. Again, it goes back to this point. We as a country, clearly, we expect more of our congressmen and women that they understand the basics of isms in our society, and they don't. And that's why it was embarrassing to have that black woman stand up behind him, not be able to speak, and cart her out and tokenize her in order to represent that the president is not racist. It's embarrassing on his part.
Now, of course, I should note the president has noted many times, I'm, quote, the least racist person you will meet. But
no one who's racist ever thinks they are.
I guess that's probably true. I do want to ask, though, so we're in this, I don't want to say it's a rabbit hole, but will any of this matter in the investigations into election interference in the 2016 election? We're talking about racism in Congress and the president's views, and it's like, how did we get here from the Russia investigation and Mueller and Cohen and all of it, Jennifer?
Right. I mean, that's the thing. This is just showmanship. And, you know, quite honestly, like, this is all fascinating for books and for selling, you know, smut magazines and for radio talk shows. I mean, this is all awesome stuff, right? However, the American public, we are paying these people to conduct these hearings. In the meantime, what I would like to see is some action go on in Congress. I would like to see some bills get passed. I would like to see some legislation. I would like to see some of the tough things that are going on in the U.S., whether it goes from the opioid epidemic to real significant immigration reform. I think that that's what they should be working on. And this, I think, what happened this week is just a circus.
Yeah, but Michael, I mean, this is a very important thing that if our democracy was compromised by a foreign power, Congress should be
looking
at.
That's not what
they
were talking about. What they were talking about is just information that everyone received even before the elections. Nothing was talked about Russia.
Well, I tend to think of the hearing in a few different ways. So one is the sort of I don't want to call it social or political piece, which is people are getting to get a chance to look at our president through the eyes of his attorney. And the claims that he has. So some of them are softer topics. They're not going to lead to a crime. But then there are other things like the president's awareness of the WikiLeaks release of the emails.
There's the Trump Moscow Tower.
The Trump Moscow Tower and the timing of that and the lying about that. To me, I don't know if those results will result in a criminal complaint. However, they speak volumes to us as voters about the president we have. That's the importance of that hearing.
Well, and I think also someone on our Radio Boston staff here mentioned this week about New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's approach to questioning Cohen, because it seemed like she was spending her time maybe setting the table for future investigations. Let's listen to what she said.
To your knowledge, did the president ever provide inflated assets to an insurance company?
Yes.
Who else knows that the president did this?
Alan Weisselberg, Ron Lieberman, and Matthew Calamari.
And where would the committee find more information on this? Do you think we need to review his financial statements and his tax returns in order to compare them?
Yes, and you'd find it at the Trump Org.
So is this AOC signaling the Democratic tactic here, you know, witnesses the Democrats might bring in and taking aim next to the president's taxes?
Yes. I mean, quite possibly. And I think that she is setting the table. You know, these members of Congress are new. They're freshmen. They've definitely been coached by the older, wiser ones that have been waiting for this to happen. You know, but again, I think that the president was probably a pretty savvy business person. And whether or not he was the one who actually did those filings and wrote the information, or it was someone else that did it for him, is the question.
And Cohen and his testimony, which I think is a powerful piece, and I think we've seen this about our president. Nothing happens without his knowledge, mm-hmm. right? And that was the testimony that Cohen provided. Three different books, I think there potentially could be, of the Trump Organization to hide things. I think it's worth an investigation. For many of us, I believe this is inevitable to lead to impeachment or to him not being reelected. But I think for many of us in this country, that would be a positive outcome.
Yeah, I think, Michael, I think you're being very, very hopeful. I don't think it's going to rise to the level of impeachment. The Senate is still held by the Republicans. Yeah. They're not going to let it happen. And on top of it, the Democratic Party needs to actually find a candidate that could beat Trump. Because even when that Entertainment Tonight piece came out, right before the election, and everyone thought that he was
Access
Hollywood. Sorry, every time when people thought that he was done after that, he was still not done after that, and he made the statement that he could shoot someone in the face in the middle of Fifth Avenue and still get away with it. And that's basically, unless the Democratic Party can find a candidate that other people can rally around, he gets reelected.
And I don't disagree with that. I think it's really about the Mueller investigation. So I'm not predicting anything. But I'm looking forward to the report coming out, if it does come out, and if there are findings. I think it will lead, and it'll be a test for Republicans. Mm-hmm. If there are findings of crimes on this president, it'll speak volumes about how partisan we are.
And I do want to note that, again, Cohen didn't make the biggest claim of them all, collusion with Russia, in his testimony. But okay, let's shift gears here before we run out of too much time and talk about another story, one that's reverberating across the country and New England.
This charge is a first-degree misdemeanor, punishable by up to 1 year in jail, a mandatory $5,000 fine, 100 hours of community service, and a class on the dangers of prostitution and human trafficking.
Now that's Florida State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg on Monday announcing that Patriots owner Robert Kraft was officially charged with solicitation of prostitution after visiting a Jupiter, Florida massage parlor. Robert Kraft has pleaded not guilty this week, and even before the official charges, his spokesperson put out a statement that said, quote, "We categorically deny that Mr. Kraft engaged in any illegal activity." What do you make of that wording, saying that Kraft had not engaged in any illegal activity? Jennifer,
God,
shaking your head
I
here.
Mean, seriously, you know, first of all, fire the PR person and fire your limo driver. Those are the two first people I
would
fire.
Those are the first takeaways on this?
Yes, if I was Robert Kraft. My first two would be the limo driver should have never taken him there and should have said, hey, by the way, you're a pretty famous person. Anyone's going to notice what you're doing. Yeah. And then his PR person, you cannot categorically deny.
He's going to have some agency over his own decisions too.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but I mean he shouldn't have been there in a world where, one, it's 2019 and we've been talking about the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. Sex trafficking is slavery. It's sex slavery. That is exactly what that is. And he should know, as someone who is as philanthropic as he is, he should know that this is something that, forget about what you want to do. He is a very, you know, popular persona. I'm sure he could get enough women. He does not need to go and do that.
Michael.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who recently was defending and supporting someone who the media would have told you was guilty, I'm 100% a fan of the process playing out. And let's see the evidence and let let him have his day in court.
Right.
That being said, if you go public opinion based on what's been released by the police department, it would seem he's guilty. I think Bob has some atonement to do. One, just even being in that place. And I think he needs to speak to that. It is a high standard we put our players to, and we see constantly every day a story about a player in this country doing similar bad things. The owners are held to even a higher standard.
And I think you're important to know. I think it's important, and thank you for noting that there's still a lot we don't know about this case, and it will play out in a court of law. But at least one of the issues that it does bring to the fore, as we mentioned, is this issue of sex trafficking, sparking maybe a larger conversation about the pervasiveness of this type of exploitation. On Radio Boston this week, we spoke with Audrey Morrissey. She's a survivor of commercial sexual exploitation who now works for the nonprofit My Life, My Choice. And she says that we've made this all about craft and not the victims.
The reality is that we have to look at, we keep hearing one name over and over again. The names that I'm concerned about are the victims. And again, how we can help and what we can do for the victims of commercial sexual exploitation.
So do you think we're too caught up in the sort of tabloid nature of this story, Jennifer?
Of course. I mean, that's why I said it's, you know, people say, oh, this is prostitution. Yes. However, it's more than that. This is sex trafficking. That sounds like a fluffy word of saying exactly what it is. These women are taken. They are forced to stay there. They are forced to perform these acts. It is a form of slavery. And we need to work to make sure that this has an end. And maybe at the very end of all of this, when craft comes out on the other side, maybe it's an opportunity for him to, you know, put more resources into this type of education to help women rise up and not be in situations where they are forced or they feel like they have to be in this business.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, one, sometimes situations elevate our consciousness, and I think him being so well known is introducing us to this issue. If you didn't know before, you know what human trafficking is now, mm-hmm. and you know the impact. Just here in Massachusetts, it even inspired me to kind of look at numbers. The work that, a credit to Attorney General Mara Healey and the work that she's done here in Massachusetts, the findings in Beverly and Lynn and Springfield. And I was reminded to go back and look at Governor Patrick's bill that he had signed, anti-trafficking law in 2011. Since then, more than 40 people have been charged in connection with trafficking crimes just here in Massachusetts. That's important for us to know that.
And I should also note that, you know, maybe we need to look at Johns as well, the people
yes.
who are purchasing these services.
Yes.
Anyway, this has been a heavy week
it's
in
a
review.
Heavy week.
Yes.
So maybe let's carve out some time here for our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Jennifer, I'll start with you.
So I live in the city, and one of our biggest problems are rats. And I always laugh that sometimes our rats are the size of polar bears. Or Well, this week in the North End, it seems as though a seagull decided to take care of the rat population on his own and suck up a rat.
So we started the show with maybe a rat.
Yeah.
Michael, what's your hubbub?
Well, I think this has been such a crazy week in the news. I feel like I need a drink, and I'm not much of a drinker. So my hubbub is the Polar, the Worcester-based company in Harpoon, announced this new line of hard seltzers last Sunday. The name that was released was Arctic Summer, something for us to think about.
What does that taste like?
I don't know, but I want to find out.
Fresh.
So I'm going to find out as soon as I leave here.
All right. I could go for one of those. My hubbub is about our addiction to our cell phones. And I know I check my phone a lot. I haven't checked it in the last 20 minutes. But at the end of last week, Kevin Roos wrote a great piece in the New York Times about how he ditched his smartphone addiction and unbroke his brain. He went on a digital detox and locked his phone in a box and installed a bunch of apps and spent some time reading something called a book. And I feel this pull to unplug and get away from everything, but maybe not entirely. So this week was the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, and there are some new products on the market that can help people do just that. One of them is called the Punked Phone. It looks like a standard calculator or like a remote control type thing.
Yeah.
And all it does is calls and texts. It's a little pricey, $350. But my money's on a better deal that pushes all the right nostalgia buttons. It's a Nokia phone. It looks like a brick, and it can call, text, and the battery lasts for 25 days.
Wow.
And it costs $79.
So wow. I like
if you want to unplug, get a new Nokia phone.
Can,
who knew?
Can we get some for free for teenagers?
Exactly. I mean, $79 compared to $1,000 for a new smartphone. That's pretty good. Michael Curry is the former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and currently a member of the national board of the NAACP. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thank
Have
you
a good
for
weekend.
Having me. Yep, you too.
And Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the Massachusetts GOP and CEO of Reflect Us. Jennifer, thank you as well. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Right now at the Heinz Convention Center, thousands of sports professionals are gathered to talk about growth and innovation in the use of data in sports. And with us now from the 2019 MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hello, Shira.
Hello, Jamie.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's actually a really exciting environment here. A lot of buzz about what's next in sports and what's next in sports data. I know it might sound a little bit wonky, not your typical sports fair, but there's a lot of energy here and a lot of crazy, exciting things going on.
What is on the forefront of sports analytics and data?
Well, I think a lot of it is talking about how to better engage fans, how to put a better product out in stadiums and various venues, how to adapt those stadiums and venues so that they can have more technological bells and whistles. Also, there's obviously some talk about the legalization of gambling and how that's going to affect how fans consume games and what data can do to aid sort of what's going to be a betting surge in the United States. So that's a lot of, you know, what's being buzzed about.
Interesting.
Here.
Do you think that'll feed the other direction, that people betting on games will change how the games are played?
I don't know if it'll change how the games are played, but it'll certainly change how the games are consumed. And it'll certainly change, from the perspective here, is it'll certainly change the type of data people want about players, about teams, about matchups. So they're all, you know, there's obviously it's a business conference run by a business school. So they're looking at, you know, where's the revenue stream with that? Where's the profit-making ability?
Mm-hmm. So big names there. What are you expecting?
Tons.
Who are you expecting?
Tons. Oh, my God. It's like a who's who. I mean, this is arguably the biggest sports conference to take place in the country each year. So you have owners and general managers from every league is represented both in the United States and foreign leagues. You've got Jeannie Buss, the Lakers owner. The NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, is speaking now. You had Paul Pierce on a panel earlier talking about basketball analytics. You are going to have the Celtics owners here talking about the Celtics-Lakers rivalry. An interesting addition to the lineup this year was Meek Mill, the hip-hop artist. He talked about social justice and sports. So a lot going on. And we cannot forget that Governor Charlie Baker is coming up at 4 o'clock, and he's going to be talking about the wild west of analytics and the role of data in decision-making from the perspective of a variety of industries, not just sports industries.
So transportation, maybe?
I don't know. We'll see. I think transportation might be on the docket, but I know that healthcare is certainly on the docket there, and it's going to look at both the use and misuse of data, and I think gambling may factor into that conversation as well.
And Shira, you're leading a panel tomorrow about data, using data to evaluate and track athletes. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the panel is called Unlocking Potential, the Next Generation of Tracking Data. And really, it looks at the data we're now collecting through wearables and through other ways of measuring athlete performance and what that means not only for the athletes. Obviously, it helps them train better, may help them prevent injuries, but what it could mean long term in terms of how their contracts are negotiated. If you see something in tracking data, can a team then negotiate or will a team negotiate negotiate differently with that data in hand? And also, how can this tracking data be used to enhance in-game experience? Are we going to be seeing, for example, if a field goal kicker has a big kick, game-winning kick on the line, might we see someday his heart rate broadcast on the Jumbotron in an arena?
Wow, during the game, yeah.
During the game, exactly. So how are we tracking athletes? And then how can that data be used in a variety of ways on a variety of platforms?
So one person who spoke at today's conference was Jonathan Kraft. He's, of course, the son of Patriots owner Robert Kraft, who we discussed earlier in the show, was charged and pleaded not guilty to soliciting prostitution. Has this been a topic of discussion or sort of elephant in the room at this conference today?
You know, it's interesting. You would have thought it would have come up more frequently. It hasn't. I've been a bit surprised by that, just not even in the chit-chat, but I think this is day one, and people have been really focused on what panels are being offered. And this is a bit of, for lack of a better word, a very nerdy, numbers-focused crowd, and they are really, really focused on the analytics for the most part.
Got it. But you have been following this story for WBUR.
Yes.
So do you have any updates for us on the case?
Yeah, recent court documents that came out show that Kraft has pleaded not guilty, or his lawyer has pleaded not guilty on his behalf, and he has requested a non-jury trial. And I think all signs point toward the fact that, you know, he wants this, he doesn't want to make headlines with this case. They are doing everything to keep this case, I know this seems sort of ironic to say it, but as quiet as possible at this point. They are doing everything to keep this from becoming even more of a public spectacle and even more of a circus.
And do you think he'll get that?
I think you can't unring the bell at this point,
yeah.
And it seems like the bell has pretty well been rung. I mean, this is, as you mentioned earlier, sort of the talk not only of the region but also of the country. So whatever developments there are going to be in this case will be closely followed. It's also worth mentioning that the next hearing, there is a hearing coming up on March 27th, and so that's sort of the next key date to be aware of.
Okay, well, we'll be following that. I know you mentioned that there were some famous Celtics players at the conference.
Yep, Paul Pierce was here.
Yeah. But the Celtics are not doing too well. What's up with that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, well, they haven't won a game since the All-Star break. They are riding their longest losing streak of the season, 4 games in a row. And, you know, basically, this is a team that everyone thought would be, but you know, in the finals, contending for a championship, and they simply have not lived up to expectations. It's widely considered that the first 2 spots in the Eastern Conference are sort of locked up, that they're unattainable for the Celtics, particularly if they keep playing the way they're playing, and they're now just sort of playing to get a decent seed, a 3, 4, 5 seed at this point, ideally a 3 or 4 seed, so you can have some home court advantage during the playoffs. So what's happening? That's the big mystery, right?
Actually,
not so much of a mystery in the sense that this is a team that just has lacked chemistry, has not come together as a team this year the way many people thought they would. And you can tell that in the body language in some games. They are just not playing as a cohesive whole. That being said, their last loss, and I know it seems odd to say this, but their last loss, which was a 97-92 loss to the Portland Trailblazers, the players and Coach Brad Stevens did see some positive signs in those games, and they were saying, you know, listen, the effort looked like, you know, it was there. It looked like we really wanted to be on the court together and play well. The shots simply weren't going down. So there is some hope. They have a game tonight against Washington, so maybe they are on the cusp of turning this losing streak around.
So you think they'll get their groove back by tonight?
Yeah,
sure,
and you know what?
Prediction.
Yes, they'll get their groove back. And you know, the funny thing about, you know, the way basketball and all sort of pro sports seasons run is this. You know, what matters is the playoffs. So once you're in, if you can gather momentum during the playoffs, we could very well see them, if not in the finals, maybe once again in the Eastern Conference Finals.
All right. That's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer joining us live from the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717. Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna.
Are you doing that on purpose? Or can't you make up your mind?
That's the trouble. I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain. Only straw.
How can you talk if you haven't got a brain?
I don't know. But some people without brains do an awful lot of talking, don't they?
That, of course, are the very first moments between Dorothy, Judy Garland, and Scarecrow in the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz. And those smart words from a man without a brain were spoken by Dorchester native Ray Bolger. Bolger's Scarecrow captured the public's imagination some 80 years ago and still today. And he was a star in his own right with a career in theater and movies, television and dance that spanned over 50 years. So why don't we know more about his career as a dancer on the streets of Boston? Well, author Holly Van Leeuwen is trying to change that. She's the author of the first biography of Bolger. It's titled Ray Bolger, More Than a Scarecrow. Holly, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Jamie. It's a pleasure.
So you've been working on this book for 10 years. What caught your attention about the Scarecrow and Ray Bolger?
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. I myself am still in my 20s. I've been involved in studying musicals of the 1930s and 40s since I was a child, really. And like many people, I was first captivated by The Wizard of Oz. And there's so much going on in that movie, from the special effects to, of course, the performances. And a lot of people have told me in the course of researching this book that Ray is really the one as the Scarecrow that sticks in their minds and has a real emotional pull for them. And so I began over years just sort of casually researching him and finding what I could. It snowballed into a much bigger effort that took me to all kinds of far-flung places. I actually moved to Boston around the time that I learned about his own origins here in Dorchester and Cambridge, how he learned to dance in the streets of the Back Bay and Scully Square.
Yeah, tell us about that. Dancing in the streets.
What is that about? So Ray Bolger was born in 1904. He came of age sort of in the teens and the 20s, and he had a sort of difficult home life. His mother passed away when he was 15. His father had health problems. They came from the working class, and he was one of two children. He was the oldest. He had a younger sister. But really, the family struggled financially, and I can't really think of a person, if you just looked at his early life, that would be less likely to become an icon of American cinema.
He was a bank teller at one point, right?
Yeah, so he had to work. He had jobs to support his family. He worked at the First National Bank of Boston, and he also worked at New England Mutual Life. He was eventually fired from New England Mutual Life by an efficiency expert because he came in late. And he came in late because the office was right there on Milk Street. And he was enchanted by the performers of Scully Square, by vaudeville, by burlesque. And that was a time in the teens and the 20s where dance was such a part of the everyman's culture. There were people down there, you could see, you know, very cheap performances.
In Scully Square,
which, exactly.
Just for folks who might not know where that is, could you describe it for us?
Yeah, so it's kind of down, the easiest way to think of it is sort of that government center-ish area that goes by Washington mm-hmm, Street. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there would be challenge dances that come up just on the streets. They're seeing a performer in town and they're doing steps out on the sidewalk. And it was very sort of fluid. There was, you know, a lot of vaudeville presence. So you could find performers. And so much of tap dance in particular, which Ray Bolger is actually known for, you don't see so much of that in The Wizard of Oz. But tap is very iterative. And so you learn a lot through mimicry. And so you're finding people who can teach you cool steps and combinations. And then you're running to the other side of town because you've heard so-and-so is an old vaudevillian who could show you something. And so really that was what captivated Ray Bolger's imagination as a young man. He had plenty of family problems. He could have gone down a much different path, really. But there was something in that that was so freeing for him. And he was very, very good at it. And he learned how to connect with audiences. And he learned how to kind of pull on the emotional heartstrings of people. And in the performances that we have of him that are preserved on film, we certainly see that in the Scarecrow performance. But also just contemporary accounts of him. This was a man who actually became a Broadway star. He essentially ran away to vaudeville after his early days in Boston.
Yeah, so how does he go from Scully Square to The Wizard of Oz?
Exactly. It's a pretty big trajectory for him. So he actually learned to dance not only from his contemporaries in Boston, other young men, other people looking to break in. It was much easier to do that back then, by the way. You know, everybody could get in on the action. There wasn't really an established celebrity system back then or anything. So it was kind of a free-for-all. But he learned to dance primarily from two different studios in the Boston area. One was O'Brien School for Social and Formal Dancing, which he did not excel at particularly. But he also learned to dance from a Russian ballet teacher in the Back Bay. Hmm. And from that, we actually see a lot of his character dance. He also specialized in what is known as eccentric dance.
They called him rubber legs,
exactly,
right?
Because he had this very natural flexibility. So when you see the Scarecrow doing the splits in The Wizard of Oz, you think that's kind of a sight gag or something. But for decades before and after, he could go down into a full split and pull himself out of it and go down and come up. He was highly flexible. He could do the high kicks. He could do a lot of hip action. So he was experiencing all that as a young man. He was finding what his range of motion was and what he could do, and he was having fun. And so actually, from his dance classes, he got recruited out by the owner of a repertory company, who said, "I didn't really hire him for his skill as much as for his funny-looking face at the time." So he really got his start kind of in comedy, using comedy for dance, touring all kinds of small towns in very intimate settings. And from there, he was able to break into the New York theater scene and to dance and eventually work his way up through into Broadway.
And then eventually to movies.
And then to movies, exactly.
So we actually have a clip here of a 1936 film, The Great Ziegfeld, where Bolger starred as himself. And here's just a little bit of him dancing around a stage. It's filled with women in very elaborate, frilly dresses.
If she's riding in the limousine with some millionaire or a college dean, if she's the grandest thing you've ever seen, then she's not my girl. If her smile is like the southern skies with California sunshine in her eyes, if she's the type that you could idolize, then she's not the girl for me.
So despite his success in this movie and his success on Broadway, as you're telling us about, when he was cast in The Wizard of Oz, it was because the film wanted people who weren't that famous to be in it? Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the clip that we just heard from The Great Ziegfeld, that was actually a really pivotal moment for Ray's life. And that was really what took him from being primarily a Broadway star into Hollywood. Mm. So the story of The Wizard of Oz is actually rife with coincidences of all kinds. The reason that MGM asked Ray to perform in The Great Ziegfeld was because he had been a high success in a show called Life Begins at 8:40 on Broadway, which was written in part by Yipper Harburg and Harold Arlen, who would go on to write the music and the film book for The Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm. and also the lyrics. And so he was finally lured out. This was a time where when the Hollywood studio systems were setting up, they were pulling so much talent from Broadway because they knew they could sing, they could dance, they could act. Ray really tried to find the right moment to jump. He didn't want to go before he was too soon, not established enough on Broadway. So what happened with The Great Ziegfeld was they gave him essentially a two-picture contract to try things out. Hmm. And this was the first film that he did for MGM. And this film, actually, for its time, was really something. It's the biopic of Florence Ziegfeld, known for the Ziegfeld Follies. It was developed in part by Ziegfeld's widow, who is Billy Burke, who would become Glinda in The Wizard of Oz. So these people are all really interconnected. Film and Broadway are very fluid at this time. And he did so well in this film. The film won Best Picture, and he really had a name for himself. And so they put him in a picture contract, something a little bit more formal. But how, what do you do with somebody like that? He's so fluid. He's so individual.
You cast him as a scarecrow,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So he was actually so frustrated with Hollywood because he's a very improvisational type dancer. He thought it was very regimented. There's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of stopping and recording taps and then going back and trying to dance. So he was really almost ready to throw in the towel. And they said, well, we have one movie that we think is just right for you. And so he stuck it out for The Wizard of Oz. And as he actually said throughout his life, he said, I've never received residuals for The Wizard of Oz, just immortality, and I'll settle for that. So it ended up being a good deal for him.
And he had, you know, there's so much to talk about.
I know.
I would love to, if we could, also talk about his wife, Gwen, because
yes.
You write so beautifully in the book, you say the importance of Gwen entering Ray's life cannot be overstated. She was a surprising choice for his bride, but their union was the prime reason that Bulger became a star. Can you tell us briefly about his wife, Gwen?
Absolutely. So I'll let Ray do a little talking. But in his day, Ray said of Gwen, Gwen does everything for me except dance. And as I put forth in the book, at the heart of Ray, he was what I call the timeless wanderer. He was a vaudevillian. He loved the shtick. He loved the intimacy. He loved being in front of a live audience. And had he not had Gwen, who he actually met in vaudeville, she was in the audience of a show that he came out and he was performing in, and she saw immediately what he could be. Ray on his own would have kind of stuck in the small time, I think. And Gwen really saw him and said, if we clean up your act, if we change the way you dress, if we change your character a little bit.
We change everything about you,
yeah.
I guess.
Except she really saw the heart of him. She saw the physicality, the talent, and of course they blended very well personally. So he really came to trust her, and she advised him on all sorts of things. Ray won a Tony Award on Broadway in 1949 for Best Actor in a Musical. It was a full decade after The Wizard of Oz, and she was actually the first female producer of a musical comedy for her contributions to that stage show. So she was a force of nature. She really understood business and art, and she got a lot of training here in Boston. When he would try out different shows here, she was learning as the shows were being put together. So she became highly, highly influential and respected for what she did. She could be very opinionated, mm-hmm. but people learned to respect that, especially as it related to Ray, because they knew that nobody understood him as well as she did.
So speaking of someone who's a force of nature in the business, I also want to talk about Judy Garland.
Absolutely.
Because they had this sort of lifelong friendship and relationship. And I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Bulger on the Judy Garland Show in 1964, where he reflects with her about the movie and how it was one of his greatest life memories.
I was brought up on the books of The Wizard of Oz, and my mother told me that these were great philosophies. It was a very simple philosophy that everybody had a heart, that everybody had a brain, that everybody had courage. These were the gifts that given you come on this earth. And if you use them properly, you reach the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And that pot of gold was a home.
Yeah.
And home isn't just a house or an abode. It's people, people who love you and that you love. That's a home.
So what is it about this movie that calls to people even now, decades later?
I think it really is the emotional pull. There has to be something to the fact that we all see it, most of us do, when we're very young. And so it holds that kind of nostalgia. But the glue that I think, having watched it thousands of times, that really holds it together is the love that Judy Garland and Ray Bulger actually have for each other. You know, there's that whole perfect line at the end, I'll miss you most of all.
Let's hear that. Let's hear that, guys.
You know, I know it isn't right, but I'm going to miss the way you used to holler for help before you found your courage.
I would never have found it if it hadn't been for you.
I think I'll miss you most of all.
So in the last, 45 seconds that we have here, Holly, what is it about the Scarecrow and about Ray Bulger that we can take with our lives today?
What you see in that clip in particular in the whole movie, which is also why Judy and Ray had a great personal relationship. Ray was really a child at heart. And through all kinds of things that happened to him, he went through every major, basically, era of show business into Las Vegas. He never lost that childish sense of innocence. And he showed us how we could find that in ourselves. And that comes out in the performances and the films that we still have available to us.
Well, that's Holly Van Leeuwen. She's the author of the new biography, Ray Bulger, More Than a Scarecrow. She'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. There's more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Holly, thank you for this book, and thank you for bringing Ray's story to Radio Boston today.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Radio Boston today and this week. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.